I just thought the 250th anniversary, and we celebrate that we've lasted as long as a constitutional democracy. But it's a golden opportunity. What better opportunity to go back into the history, especially the Declaration, and see what we can learn and see what the values are and are they enduring values and so forth. And let's go through just a brief history. The British colonies in America, some of them founded by Dutch or French or Spanish, but they became British colonies, were generally a happy association until maybe toward the middle of the 1700s. Benjamin Franklin, probably as early as 1750, began advocating that the colonies, the state, should be independent. Great Britain. So the conversation had been brewing. King George III came to the throne in 1760, same time Methodists first arrived in America. He was 22 years old. He wanted to be a good king. He wanted to protect and preserve the empire. So he's in mid-30s by the time we get to this crisis. The crisis got in high gear in 1763 when the British finally defeated the French and sort of ran them into Quebec or New Orleans or back to France. Keep in mind, Britain is at that time was the greatest empire the world had ever known, the biggest navy the world had ever known, very powerful military. You don't want to go up against Great Britain. Okay, so, but Great Britain is always in world war with Spain and France in particular, Spanish and French, always in world war. They're fighting over sea lanes and who controls the sea and their colonies all over the world. It's expensive to be an empire. All empires, if and when they fall, it's because they have overextended, they have overreached, and they can't afford it anymore. Hello, America. All right, that's another topic. So Great Britain finally said, well, we freed the colonies from French influence, and so we think the colonies should pay up on this war debt. And they were deeply in debt. And so that started the taxation plans, various kinds, to bring revenue to London. And the since the colonists had no representation, remember, taxation without representation. We learned that in fourth grade. So that was a complaint. We're not represented in Parliament to have a voice. We don't like these taxes. They're unfair, they're oppressive, and so forth. And with King George in the seat, it was always more pressure, always more pay up philosophy, you know, because we've done you so much good, and you should be so happy to be British citizens. That built up. I mean, they tried everything, tax on tea and stamps and paper and all kinds of things to try to bring in revenue. And gradually, it so insulted the colonists that this tension keeps building. And every time King George authorized something new, it was a negative that only served to build up more pressure. And he never had the common sense wisdom to realize the value of conversation and compromise, and to listen to the many, many, many petitions from America that were sent to him for us to negotiate this stuff. Well, for him, he was a little self-righteous. He was a little puritanical, not a word appropriate to use, but he believed they should be grateful and they should obey and they should recognize the sovereignty of the king. And that authority system, you know, goes right down to the ground. And so it was always this tug of war. And every time the Americans pushed back, he pushed back. So it accelerated the tension. They, in an attempt to put down this rebellion, they took over Massachusetts. They disaffiliated Massachusetts from some kind of self-governing and put their own system in. And General George Gage, governor, was the one that was going to be over Massachusetts. So all these things are build up more and more tension. So we let's rapidly then get to when King George and Parliament decided, okay, we're going to send enough force to put this down. And General Gage, who was in charge, he'd been in America 30 years, married an American woman. He actually loved America, loved the citizens, the people. He was trying to keep the peace, but London is ramping up the pressure on him to put down this rebellion. So he asked for enough reinforcements to launch what he thought was going to be a successful raid on Concord. And Concord was where the Patriots, rebels, whatever we want to call them, had started stockpiling weapons and gunpowder. And, word gets out and he finds out. And so he plans this assault on Concord to destroy the arsenal. He had about, I don't know, maybe 2,000 to 6,000 troops at that time. He probably took 2,000 in the middle of the night. Here's where Paul Revere comes in. Not just because of the midnight ride. Paul Revere had been working for 2 years to set up a communication system and a response system. And how will we know? How will we signal? Who will come? That's where the Minutemen come in. The militias around, all the farmers and everybody. They all had guns, of course. So Gage goes in the middle of the night. Paul Revere has informants. And historians are quite certain that the informant all the time was Gage's wife, Margaret. And her channel was through James Warren. I think that's his first name. He was prominent, highly respected, was killed in the Battle of Bunker Hill. Highly treasured. She would pass on information to him, he would pass it on, to the system. So they were as ready as they could be. So they get intercepted, they know it's coming. And then Paul Revere, of course, and other riders get on the horse and they spread the news. Conflict, violence breaks out at Lexington and then on to Concord. And the probably as many as 4,000 rebel troops were waiting. And so the shock heard around the world was there on the bridge in Concord. To make a long story short, they beat the British soldiers all the way back to Boston. Killed probably over 200, maimed, wounded. It was a devastation for Gage's operation. And so they take cover back in Boston and plan to fight another day. So the war broke out on April 19th, 1775. We're already in war. Violence had even preceded that. But so what is London? Okay. We don't, Gage didn't do a good job, so he eventually gets replaced. That's on down the line. But so, okay, they're going to ramp up the next phase of putting down the rebellion. And that comes, we're moving now into closer to 1776. The First Continental Congress had met in 75 and had started planning. They didn't meet but about 6 weeks. And then the Second Continental Congress began in May on May the 10th of 1776. I mean, everything is moving to a crisis. At about the same time, a month later, massive flotilla of ships and soldiers set sail from Nova Scotia, Halifax, Nova Scotia, headed for America. And it was like 140 or 50 ships, between 32 and 40,000 troops, and they were headed for Long Island and Charleston Harbor. And so the war is very much intensifying. In that second Continental Congress, they authorized the states to start writing their own constitution and preparing to defend themselves. They named George Washington as the commanding general of the Continental Army. He headed for Boston, and it just began planning, armaments and how we're going to fight this war. How we're going to raise an army? Well, they didn't have a Continental Army. They just had militias in the states. So you got all this crisis coming to a head, and so it builds up to June of 1776. Continental Congress still in session. And all this is happening, and the armada is coming, the assault is coming. And they gotta think fast and work fast. And they came to a decision. Now, there've been other declarations by states or individuals or whatever, desiring independence. But never from the Continental Congress. And they decided they had to do that to draw a line in the sand to say, we mean this, and to rally the states and rally the troops. And so they come to a time of declaration. Thomas Jefferson was there, and they named a committee of five, including John Adams, to draft the first draft of the Declaration. And so you can read Jefferson's original. It's pretty much the same, but he had some interesting words in there that we'll mention a little bit later, that were edited out or whatever. He also had Benjamin Franklin in the room. He was on the Committee of Five. He was a scientist. And anything bordering on religious or sacred language, he pushed back a little bit. They got the same thing done, but anyway, that's a little side story. Now let's then go to the Declaration. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station, to which the laws of nature, and nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that we should declare the causes, which was Jefferson's. He was eager to get to the causes, and they're lengthy. We're not going to go into those today. Let's join our voices then. And we hold these truths. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that above these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to deliver these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government. That states three or four founding principles of the United States of America. We'll look into that more carefully. First thing I want to say is Jefferson meant all men are created equal, as generic. So there was a, well, let's just say there was a tremendous amount of inequality in play that they knew at the time, even if they wanted to, they couldn't fix. A declaration is not going to fix inequality. It declares a principle and a value and an ideal toward which you're working. So this signals what Jefferson and then the Committee of Five and then Continental Congress endorsed, that this related to nature's God. So these are God-given qualities of human beings and God-given rights that should not be defiled, should be obeyed. They declare that all of us are safe people of sacred worth. What's the first sentence of the Belmont inclusion statement? Anybody repeat it? It's got the same language in it. All people are of sacred worth. That's foundational to everything else, foundational to hospitality and inclusion and so forth. So we give Jefferson a little credit here to say that he really meant all children, all newborns, all women created equal and by the Creator, and given these natural inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So every person also has independence. We're not just declaring a nation of 13 states independent, but this implies that every one of us comes with a certain independence over ourselves and our bodies and our rights to life, liberty, and freedom. It declares a belonging. It declares what will eventually become true in America, the right of voice, which is the right to vote. Now, when we get into diversity, I just want to preach the gospel that America was diverse from day one. It was diverse. It began to be diverse when the Vikings first came. It began to be diverse when the Dutch got here, when the Spanish got here, when the British got here, when the French got here. We were already diverse in ethnicity, nationality, and language and systems of belief. And I want to declare an independence in saying DEI is America's DNA. Bar none. The diversity that landed here in ships as settlers, to have a new life and new time, was there from the beginning, and we had to work out how this could work. So Pauline Meyer says that the Declaration then was made into a sacred text. And she's not a religious person trying to drive, Christianity into the American experience. She's just stating a fact. Now, it may not have dawned on all of the readers of the Declaration as it got printed and distributed in the coming days, but the value got embedded in the lives and hearts of Americans. And we'll go into some of the history. We, the people, drifted a little bit away from the Declaration over decades. But as we've gone through change and systems getting revised and all of that, we tend to go back to that Declaration. All men are created equal. Which also meant that no one held authority over anyone else by right of birth or gift of God. Let that soak in. The authority structure that Great Britain represented and all of the countries of Europe represented and all the other empires of the world was a top-down system. There is a sovereign, and all other sovereignties Oh, under that, it was a system of subservience to the chain of command and right down to the grassroots level. So the governor of Massachusetts, whatever, had authority over you. And if the point of a gun needed to prove that, then it could be proven. Pauline Meyer says that these principles and values took on a transcendent importance. And in all of our arguments about was America started as a Christian nation and so forth, which it needs to be talked about and debated, there's always been this sense of the transcendent involved. That is, a power higher than we are. And it's stated, of course, in the Declaration. That's one of her. It becomes the foundation of American political philosophy. That's not debatable. And what's debatable is how we've shamed it and disregarded it and all of that. We'll get into that. But the Declaration states what she says, immortal principles. The most sacred of all American political scriptures, thus her book, American Scripture. Now, mind you, she's not trying to, she's a historian and a scientist. She's not trying to force something artificial into the system. She's just observing the function of the Declaration. States the highest values of human beings. This is the long derivative of the Enlightenment, which started to privilege the human being, the human mind, science, a new way of learning science, human rights, individual rights, democratic notions, constitutional. All of these started as then as derivatives of the Enlightenment. Starting in the late 1600s, that it really we can say historically came to a head in the American experience. It was the first time any people, any society, any nation had tried to develop a system of government and the philosophy of human beings around those enlightened principles and insights. The first. And well, then we get to the sovereignty of the people. That had never been tried in human history to our knowledge. The sovereignty of us. We have the say, we hire and fire, and we pay the bills. We, the people. Consent is becoming a very powerful thread, in coming to America, consent of the people. Great Britain had made advancements in this direction. Parliament was an acknowledgement of the people, House of Commons and all of that, the elections. So they were, let's give them credit. They were the most progressive liberal empire that we had ever had. And part of the argument of the Americans was just give us the same rights, which you're not doing. You're overlooking us, you're abusing us, and so forth. So Thomas Paine, you know that name, and his Common Sense came out in early 1776, and it rallied the people. He could speak in common sense. He became a passionate American. Recent immigrant. And he writes in that volume that the American Constitution, when they get around to writing one, could form the noblest, purest constitution on the face of the earth. And addressing the people, we have the power to begin the world over again. Now, that's a little grandiose. I'm glad he believed it. And it, again, states sort of an ideal, that in some ways we have over time. But so this brings us then to the fact that with all of the transcendent divine power of, and the human mind and rights and all that, it was birthed in the midst of controversy. Now, most Americans, by the way, bought into this and rallied around it. There were about 20% of Americans. Let's be reminded, this is our first Civil War. Because loyalists who wanted to be loyal to the mother country and wanted to remain as British citizens fought against the Patriots, our first Civil War. And it was pretty brutal. About 20% of Americans, 20 to 30, I mean, it's debated, wanted to be loyalists. And some went back to England, and a whole bunch went to Nova Scotia. Anybody been to Nova Scotia? Okay. You can feel the British influence. It's more than an influence, it's a loyalty of the people of Halifax and Nova Scotia. And after all, that's where Great Britain, the flotillas, set up and got organized before they came down the East Coast. And another thing you pick up when you're in that environment is we're proud that we're not American. Now, these are Canadians that have all kinds of French influences and British and so forth. And you pick that up. Their ceremonies, their flags, and all of that is we want to be thought of as British friends, allies, whatever. And sure glad we're not American. And history. Confirm that over and over for them. And in the U.S. relation to Canada, there were always elements who wanted American forces to take over Canada. And always Canada is aware of that and fighting it off. So that's the long history. And a minority of folks came here for religious freedom. The vast majority came here for commercial opportunities. Jamestown was founded as a commercial opportunity. Didn't go so well in the beginning, but that's what it was. The Dutch coming to New York, totally commercial. The Puritans coming in 1620, that was religious. And they were coming for religious liberty. Quakers, huge volumes of Quakers came. They had, deep convictions about a lot of things to their credit. And they settled largely in Pennsylvania, and Lancaster is rich in Quaker history. And the Quaker constituency was always active and participating in all of these debates. But the power, the religious power in the beginning and at this time was the Anglican Church, because it was the American derivative of the Church of England. And the Anglicans here in America, they eventually became Episcopalians. Anglicans here in America functioned out of a lot of these authority structures. And Thomas Jefferson basically detested them because they had these notions of we rule over you. And man, Jefferson just went into ballistics, over that type of thing. The Anglican Church in the South in particular actually was able to get legislation to tax citizens to pay for the preacher. Now, is anybody could write a resolution, send it to Washington to see if the Congress would approve several $1 billion to support the church and support the preachers? No, because that's a violation of religious liberty. Let's come back to that issue of legislation sometime in the next couple of weeks. It's very fundamental to who we are, but it is so misunderstood, so misapplied. Separation church and state, so misunderstood, misapplied, but they have an importance. America was an idea taking all the Enlightenment influence that human beings are capable of self-government. Right now, we're back in a crisis. We've never had one like the one we're going through now. The Civil War was a different kind of crisis. It was terrible. Let me cite two great books for you. Colin Woodard, American Nations, plural, and I believe it's subtitled Nine Rival Cultures, something like that. You then see how the rival cultures that came and founded, are still with us. And it's very insightful. The other one is Miracle at Philadelphia. It is one of the best narratives of the Constitutional Convention. And then, by the way, Paul, I just now remembered that Pauline Meyer wrote the definitive history of ratification. You check out that book of her. Fascinating. Oh, fascinating battle. And thanks to Alexander Hamilton, took the lead. He was an immigrant who took the lead, James Madison and John Jay wrote the Federalist Papers. And they wrote at least once a week, maybe more, maybe twice a week, building support for the Constitution. And that book, by the way, the Federalist Papers, is a study in the science of government. Get you a copy of that. Notice in on your Second Continental Congress convening May 10, 1775, preamble the Declaration of Independence. The unanimous declaration of the 13 lowercase united states. Because you couldn't declare united at this point. A couple of years later, they adopted the Articles of Confederation in York, Pennsylvania, and it was basically a friendship pact. Mutual support, that type. It was a step in the right direction. Another study on that. So you can see these implications in what we read in the others. Pauline Meyer would argue that we hold these truths part is universal, and that's what people latch on to, even if they can't implement it as in a government, but they'd like to. We're going to pick up next week. Who kept fighting the struggle for for America in the positive way, and who didn't? And we'll go over that. And we're going to revisit Lincoln, of course. And what else? Anyway, I think that's it for today. Thank you so much.